From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Your salary depends more on where you live than on your resume, one of the fascinating conclusions economist Enrico Moretti makes in his new book, The New Geography of Jobs. Well, if you want to get a job, where you are is extremely important, according to Enrico Moretti, professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley. His work has been featured in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere. Enrico, you start this book with the tale of two California cities, Menlo Park and Visalia. They're only about 3 hours away by car, but they couldn't be more different. How? And how do they illustrate your thesis?
That's right. It's the story of an engineer named David Breedlove, who was trying to decide between these two cities in 1969. And at the time, these two cities were roughly the same. They had similar wages, similar industry composition, similar type of employers. One is Menlo Park in the middle of Silicon Valley, and the other one is a small town in rural California. And like many professionals at the time, David Breedlove was attracted by a quiet life, safer schools, and less pollution that rural community seemed to promise. So eventually he sold his house in Silicon Valley and moved to this rural community. Now, if you look at these two communities now, 30 years later, they're very different, but not in the way that David Breedlove and many professionals who made that choice envision. Today, Menlo Park is at the heart of one of the most successful innovation clusters in the world. It has some of the highest wages in America, one of the best educated community. It has low crime, low pollution, and within California, some of the better schools. Visalia, on the contrary, has completely lagged behind. Because it didn't have all that many college-educated workers in the 60s and the 70s, it missed out completely on the growth of high-tech. Now, its wages are among the lowest in the nation. Crime is twice as high. The quality of the schools is terrible. And every other aspect of private and social life there seems to be so much different from Menlo Park. And the reason I'm telling these stories is that I think it perfectly exemplifies what has been happening to many of our communities in the past 30 years. You know, if you look at America today, you don't see just one country. There are basically three increasingly different countries. On one end, there are cities like the area around Menlo Park, Silicon Valley and San Francisco, or cities like Seattle, or Austin, or Raleigh, that have developed a very strong innovation-based economy, and they have a labor force that is one of the most creative and best paid in the country. At the other extremes, there are cities that are there are much worse conditions, you know, Detroit, Flint, mm-hmm. Cleveland, and Visalia, which have been losing population and they're shedding jobs by the thousands. And in the middle, there is the rest of the country, which seems undecided on which direction to go.
Now, you say that these areas developed this innovation economy. But let's face it, if Bill Gates' father didn't come from Seattle, if he hadn't moved here in large part for those family connections, it might have gone a whole different direction, couldn't it?
That's right. A great story, what I think is a great story in the book, is the story of Seattle, because it's one of the wonderful success stories of American cities. Seattle today, I love Seattle. Every time I come here, I'm really happy. It's a wonderful, cosmopolitan, culturally lively community, and in part this reflects the fact that the local economy has been doing so well due to the high tech sector. But if you look at Seattle in the 70s, it was a very different community. Boeing was struggling, Packard was struggling, and the city was shedding jobs by the thousands. I'm sure many of your listeners remember when a sign went up on 5 that says, "The last one in Seattle, please turn the lights off."
Yeah.
And I think that sign perfectly exemplifies the mood of a community in decline. But then something happened in January 1979. And what happened was that a small firm that was located in Albuquerque, New Mexico, decided to relocate to Seattle. And that small firm was called Microsoft, and he moved here because its founders, both Allen and Gates, wanted to be close to their families. And that was the starting point of the high-tech cluster in this community.
So the solution to having a creative community is have the family of people who are going to be like Bill Gates or Paul Allen, and then so they want to move back to your town. I mean, it doesn't give much guidance.
That's right. But I think what's really interesting is how Seattle changed the local economy. Because, okay, sure, I'm sorry, how Microsoft changed the local economy. Microsoft has 40,000 employees. That sounds a lot. But, you know, in a metro area of 2 million people, when you include the entire Puget Sound area, that's not a lot. So I think what's really interesting and instructive is to understand how that one company reshaped the entire community.
And one of your core points here is that it wasn't just good for people who were working at Microsoft. There's this kind of knock-on effect in other areas of employment too, right?
That's right. I think that's the most important and possibly the most surprising part of the story. Every time a community is able to attract an high-tech employer, it gains not just the jobs within that employer, but it gains many more jobs outside high-tech in the local service sector. I call this the multiplier effect. And this multiplier effect is surprisingly large. I estimate that for each job in high-tech, five additional jobs are supported outside high-tech in positions, some of which require not many skills, like taxi drivers and waiters and hairdressers. But some do require a good education, like lawyers and doctors and nurses and teachers. You know, take Microsoft, for example. It has 40,000 employees in the Puget Sound areas, but indirectly supports 200,000 additional jobs in the local service sector. So remarkably, if you think about it, the main effect that Microsoft has on the Puget Sound regional economy is not in the high-tech sector. It's actually outside the high-tech sector. And that's why it matters for all of us, not just for the for the techies.
We're talking about the new geography of jobs. Enrico Moretti is the author. He's a professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley. Now, wasn't the world supposed to be getting flatter with all this technology? You could live anywhere you wanted to and participate in the knowledge economy, and geography was supposed to become less important. You're saying quite the opposite.
Yes. Pundits and experts have been arguing that the world is flat. You know, Thomas Friedman wrote one of the most successful and influential books about globalization of the past two decades, arguing exactly that geography doesn't matter anymore. That somebody in Bangalore with a Skype or a cell phone or email can have exactly the same access to information, to contacts, to coworkers than somebody sitting in Seattle or San Francisco. And the prediction of that view of the world is that the great innovation hubs of America, again, like Silicon Valley, Seattle, or Austin, should be declining because they have high cost of living, they have traffic jams, and you don't need to be here. You can just sit wherever you want. You can be in the middle of the Colorado Mountains.
Well, and communication's gotten better since Thomas Friedman promulgated that idea, so it's not as though he was wrong about us being able to connect. In fact, we can connect in ways he never quite imagined back then. So what was the missing element?
The missing element is that, contrary to his predictions, the attractive power of this innovation cluster has not diminished. In fact, it has increased. You see more and more of innovation jobs concentrated in America's great innovation hubs. You see more and more venture capitals being invested there. You see more and more R&D expenditures being spent there. And the reason is that in innovation, really face-to-face contact still matters. Our best ideas are never born in isolation. Our best ideas are always born from some serendipitous interaction with somebody that we bump into at the water cooler, at a local pub. We can communicate easily with every corner of the world, but at the same time, where we live matter more and more. And I think this is one of the great paradoxes of our times. We live in a world that is increasingly interconnected and globalized, and at the same time, it's increasingly localized, where the person that we meet and the ideas that we get exposed to matter more and more.
Now, Richard Florida has written a lot about creative centers of cities, but his kind of core contention is that cities need to create arts and culture, and that attracts these knowledge workers, these creative people. You kind of turn that on over with a couple of examples.
That's right. I think Richard Florida's book that was very, very influential 10 years ago has induced a lot of community to spend a lot of money, invest a lot of resources into trying to attract jobs by basically trying to become attractive to what he calls the creatives, the creative class. And my reading of the evidence is that it's the other way around, that communities first become prosperous by attracting good jobs, and then they start supporting a vibrant cultural scene.
And your counterexample is Berlin, which attracts a lot of creatives but has pretty big economic problems and job problems, right?
Yes, Berlin today is probably the sexiest, coolest city in Europe. It attracts thousands of cool Italians and French, highly educated young people. It has one of the cultural scenes that is probably the most vibrant in the world. It has wonderful public art. It has five symphonies. It has highbrow and lowbrow cultural offerings of any type. It has wonderful restaurants. It has a cheap housing stock. It has everything that Richard Florida ever dreamed of in terms of amenities that could attract the creatives. And it does attract a lot of creatives, but there is one problem with that there's not many jobs.
They're unemployed.
that's right. Berlin has one of the highest unemployment rate in Germany, one of the lowest per capita income in Germany. And the only reason it actually survives as a community is because it's a capital and it's receiving major transfers from all the other states in Germany. So 20 years of Berlin cool haven't really generated any sustainable economic development there. Its own mayor calls it poor but sexy. Hmm. I think it sums it up very well.
Enrico Moretti is with me. His book is called The New Geography of Jobs, where he challenges some of the conventional wisdom. And I want to ask you about your contention that one's salary depends more on where you live than your resume in just a moment. But first, we've got Tom on the line who's been listening and has a question from Capitol Hill. Tom, how you doing?
Oh, I'm fine, thanks.
What's your question?
Well, my question was, I think the professor mentioned Austin, Texas, maybe in one of his earlier comments. I was wondering, in terms of job growth, if he has any data or projections about what Austin, Texas is going to look like in the next few years.
Austin, Texas is one of the great success stories. Austin, Texas wasn't that a lot in 30 years ago, and in 30 years has become probably the second most important innovation cluster in the U.S. and keeps growing. So it's one of those remarkable examples of a community that was able to reinvent itself and grow from basically a sleepy third-level economy into a very dynamic, creative cluster. It has one of the best educated labor forces in the U.S. And, just to give you an example, in 1980, Austin, Texas salaries were below those in Flint, Michigan. Today, the salaries in Austin, Texas are double those in Flint, Michigan. And that's, again, another example in which our communities are growing apart.
You talk about gentrification, the upscaling of neighborhoods that's generally regarded as a problem. You call it a good problem, but Enrico, I have to ask you to speak to the people who call this show and say, wasn't a good problem in Fremont when my artist studio got priced out? It wasn't a good idea in Ballard when I could no longer afford an apartment. I had to move someplace else. Why is it a good problem?
Well, when you talk to mayor and policymakers of cities in the Rust Belt and you tell them that your problem is that there is too much demand for your city, and what they tell you is, I would love to have that problem. Because they have cities that are shrinking, people are leaving, and they can't find jobs for them. So I don't mean that we should be happy about gentrification. What I do mean is that gentrification is the flip side of economic success of a city. And I do take it seriously. I think gentrification does have a serious social cost for a community. But at the same time, I argue in the book that some of the policies that have been adopted, that are typically adopted by cities to fight gentrification, sometimes can backfire. The typical policy that a lot of cities in Northern California, like San Francisco, Berkeley, but also Southern California, like Santa Monica and LA, and to some extent, to a smaller extent in Seattle, The typical policy that is adopted is to basically slow down private development of new housing units in gentrified neighborhoods. And my point is that by doing so, you actually make things worse. That if you're constraining supply of new housing units, the demand will be so high that we'll bid up the price of housing even more, further increasing gentrification, not slowing it down. There are many studies that shows that there's a growing body of evidence that shows that the best way to keep local housing pricing affordable is to accommodate demand,
yeah.
Which means smart urban planning policies of infilling. So building, you know, making the neighborhood denser, building on empty parking lots, and allowing it'll be more density, and at the same time, allowing for more public transit. Those smart urban planning policies actually can go a long way in keeping gentrification in check.
Finally, you wrote, your salary depends more on where you live than on your resume. What do you have to say to the young graduates from the University of Washington and elsewhere about how that should influence whether they stay here or go somewhere else?
Well, the key predictor of a community economic success is the number of college graduates in a community. So if I was a recent college graduate today and was looking around where to live, the one thing that the most important thing that I would look at is how many college graduates are there in this community, because in the next 10 or 20 years, that's where the creative, innovative employers will locate, and that's where all the jobs for people with skills and a good education will open up.
Incidentally, or perhaps not, that's also the key predictor for a successful public radio station. So I don't know what that means. Enrico Moretti, the new book is called The New Geography of Jobs. Thank you so much for stopping by and telling us about it.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds.